The U.S. Senate votes down a Bush-era plan for expanded oil and gas development in the Outer Continental Shelf. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 23rd of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, lawmakers are upset with NSTAR's request to charge South Central customers for a $6 million error.
I just don't feel it's right that the consumers always have to cover up for mistakes made.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Litsite Alaska is a web community for families, teachers, librarians, health professionals, and Alaskans of all ages. There are thousands of pages with everything from Alaska's digital archives to kids' games, information about the state's history, culture, narrative, and healing. Teachers love Litsite Alaska. You can discover Litsite Alaska at LITSITE.org. Litsite Alaska is a project of the University of Alaska Anchorage. This message sponsored by UAA.
The Senate has voted down a Republican-led attempt to install a Bush administration plan for offshore oil and gas drilling. The legislation would have immediately approved a five-year plan to expand Outer Continental Shelf development, including off Alaska's coast. The Senate killed the amendment by Louisiana Republican David Vitter on a vote of 56-42. Just days before leaving office, the Bush administration proposed the 2010 to 2015 offshore plan, which includes parts of the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas and the North Aleutian Basin. The proposal was 3 years early. The current plan ends in 2012. President Obama's team slowed down the process when it took office and called for a lengthened public comment period, which ended this week. Alaska's Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski and Democratic Senator Mark Begich voted in favor of adopting the Bush-era plan. Two Alaska state legislators are criticizing NSTAR Natural Gas Company for what they say is a $6 million error. Representative Pete Peterson and Senator Bill Willikowski of Anchorage say NSTAR overcharged a laundry facility at Fort Richardson for gas between 2002 and 2007. Now the lawmakers say the company wants other South Central Alaska customers to pay for its mistake. KDLL's Ben Stanton reports.
Attorney General's office issued a brief to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska suggesting NSTAR did not properly calculate how much gas the laundry was using, that caused transportation companies to supply more than was needed, that extra gas was used by other customers. AG Dan Sullivan is requesting that RCA not grant NSTAR's request to pass the charge along to current and future customers. Representative Pete Peterson of Anchorage says it's simply unfair to add to consumers' bills, especially in an already tough economic climate.
I just don't feel it's right that the consumers always have to cover up for mistakes made. I mean, if in the business that I ran, if I made a mistake, it was my fault and I was the one that paid for it. I just don't think it's the right way to try to solve this problem for NSTAR.
Peterson says ratepayers could pay more than $2 a month extra for several years to make up for the $5.7 million the laundry was overcharged. The state legislature does not have any direct control over utility companies, but Peterson says legislators and residents alike can contact the RCA to express opinions.
A public opinion should have some effect on the rulings by the Regulatory Commission, I would think, and it seems to have had an effect last year when they turned down the proposed contract that NSTAR thought they had worked out that would have equal a considerable increase in the price of gas.
NSTAR spokesman John Sims says the mistake was caused by human error. He says customers are billed at different times of the month, and occasionally adjustments need to be made to balance accounts. That regular adjustment combined with the human error added up over the 5 years it occurred.
Because everyone bills at a different time throughout the year, and then there's a true-up, and that true-up is called the loss and unaccounted for. So we know what gas has gotten into the system. We know it's been billed and metered, and then there's a true-up. The national average for that loss and unaccounted for is 1%.
He says some people have blamed inaccurate metering for the problem, which he says is not true. Sims says NSTAR is at less than half of 1% for loss and unaccounted for gas. He says while $5.7 million might sound like a lot of money, adjustments happen regularly. Sometimes he says it means a decrease for other customers.
These adjustments have have occurred in the past where there's kind of a makeup. Sometimes it's a positive, sometimes it's a negative. So unfortunately, they happen from time to time where adjustments are needed, and it's common all over the utility industry.
Sims says at the time the laundry was being overcharged, other customers were being undercharged. That's why NSTAR wants to make the adjustment. And Sims says projected upcoming decrease in natural gas rates in January are expected to more than make up for the increase if it's allowed. But it's still up to the RCA to allow NSTAR to do so. The next step is an RCA hearing scheduled next month. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
Governor Sean Parnell is in Anchorage's town square now to announce this year's permanent fund dividend amount. APRN's Ellen Lockyer is there and joins us live. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Lori. You ready for the big news?
Yeah, don't keep us in suspense. What should Alaskans expect for this year's PFD?
$1,305 for every qualifying Alaska man, woman, and child.
Okay, and Ellen, did Governor Parnell address what the future outlook is for the permanent fund? There's predictions that it could decline significantly as the poor market conditions affect it.
Actually, no. His address was extremely short and to the point. He approached the podium at exactly 5, and then there was the envelope please moment and a bit of heightened drama, and then he made the announcement. And that's it, and he left.
All right. Well, thanks, Ellen. Thanks for being there for us.
All right. Thank you, Lori. Bye-bye.
APRN's Ellen Lockyer reporting live from Town Square in Anchorage that this year's permanent fund dividend will be $1,305. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Yupik Bible translation for the younger crowd.
For me, I'd like for the younger generation to be able to read the New Testament in our own new Yupik writing system.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
The nationwide launch date of the 2010 U.S. Census count is still 6 months away, but it looms much sooner for Alaska. The count will start in the state in January, when the Inupiat village of Norvik in Northwest Arctic Borough becomes the first community visited by census workers. Census Director Dr. Robert Groves joked today that news about the village's selection to be first in the nation was accidentally shared by census officials in Anchorage over the summer.
This is the most damaging leak that has occurred. Norvik, Alaska, a very small village in Alaska, will be the first population that will receive the census forms.
Groves says census officials hope to do their count in rural Alaska before breakup season, when people travel to fish camp and other jobs.
This is, in a way, a ceremonial event. But it's an important event. We have to, it turns out, enumerate Alaska early, because there's some parts of Alaska that get really inaccessible later on. So Alaska's first out of the blocks on this one, and it is true that Norvik is our selection this decade.
Only rural Alaska will be counted early. The remainder of the state will receive their census forms in the mail along with the rest of the country in March. Dr. Groves spoke to reporters in Washington, D.C. today at the first in a series of monthly updates on planning for the 2010 census. He says over the summer, census workers successfully visited every known address in the United States in preparation for the massive mail-out of census forms in the spring. Alaska had the worst response by mail rate of all the states when the census was last conducted in 2000. Groves says this spring, households will receive a second form if they don't initially respond, and then census workers will go door to door.
For every 1 percentage point reduction in the mail return rate, scores of millions of dollars are going to be spent by the taxpayers to send people out and knock on doors. For the American public who are worried about the national deficit, here's something you can do. If you return your questionnaire, you save the federal government money.
Groves says areas that have been hit hard by natural disaster will have forms hand-delivered. The 2010 census has 10 questions, and there are no long-form versions to fill out like there were in past counts. Questionnaires will be sent to households in English, but some areas will also get bilingual Spanish-English forms, and people can request questionnaires in four other languages: Chinese, Korean, Vietnamese, and Russian. Grove says the Census Bureau will also make an effort to hire bilingual enumerators or counters to go door to door.
We figure out the best way to enumerate depending on the area, and we'll tailor our methods to the area. A recent change on this, we're very interested in customizing our methods to language groups, groups that don't speak English.
Taking a census count every 10 years is mandated by the U.S. Constitution. The results are used to reapportion congressional districts and affect the distribution of more than $400 billion in annual revenue sharing and other federal funds. Lawmakers heard arguments yesterday about the legality of Alaska's cruise ship passenger head tax. The House Judiciary Committee held a hearing in Anchorage less than a week after nine cruise lines sued to throw out the revenue measure. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the story.
The hearing was scheduled before the suit was filed, but after the lines said they planned to go to court. Alaska Cruise Association attorney Steve Rummage said the tax is an entry fee. He said conditions spelling out ship size, passenger capacity, and trip duration violate constitutional protections on interstate commerce.
And when you take those requirements together, what they mean is that the tax applies only to companies that are located out of state and operate cruises in Alaska. In other words, only against interstate interests.
Head tax author Joe Geldof told lawmakers it was designed to pay for facilities and services used by ships and passengers. He said the voter-approved law creating the tax and other programs passes legal muster.
The goal of the people who did that was to make Alaska and our coastal ports the best possible cruise ship destination for a lot of reasons. And it dealt with environmental matters, it dealt with some consumer disclosure matters, and revenue matters.
Lawyers for both sides criticized the legislature's use of some of the tax money. Cruise lines said it showed the fee was illegal. Tax backers said poor decisions were made but could be corrected. Attorneys and lawmakers at the hearing debated the relevance of several recent court decisions, including one involving Valdez Tankers. But Alaska Attorney General Dan Sullivan said no case directly addresses cruise ship tourism.
1 million visitors per year in a state that has roughly 686,000 residents. It's a huge influx in a short period of time each year. Significant impacts, very significant costs.
Sullivan and other state attorneys saved more detailed discussion of the issues for a closed-door executive session that followed. Afterward, Eagle River Representative Nancy Dahlstrom, the Judiciary Committee's vice chairwoman, said the panel will monitor the lawsuit. She said it hopes to, quote, find an amicable resolution that will continue to allow the state to administer the funds from the tax appropriately and without a legal cloud. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Shrinking glaciers have turned out to be one of the clearest harbingers of global warming. But while most of the world's glaciers recede, a few in the Pacific Northwest are bucking the trend. Climate change skeptics would have you believe these examples undermine the evidence for global warming. Glacier researchers, on the other hand, can explain the aberrations. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi takes a closer look.
You're no doubt familiar with the rule, glaciers are shrinking. So we're going to focus on the snowy exceptions. We'll work from an inventory of Western glaciers assembled by Portland State University professor Andrew Fountain. The National Science Foundation commissioned this inventory. Fountain says the general rule is definitely in force.
Up here in the Northwest, we're more fortunate that we only have an area loss of somewhere between 34% and 40%.
Since the turn of the last century. Fountain counts about 8 exceptions among the several hundred glaciers he's tracking in the American West. The first one he mentions is Crater Glacier on Mount St. Helens. This would be hydrologist Joe Walder's baby.
If you're thinking of something that's going to be nice and white, you're not seeing that. It's really this very kind of dark mass because of all the rock debris that's accumulated on top.
It's a warm and sunny day, but powerful gusting winds foil Walder's plan to fly into the crater. The U.S. Geological Survey researcher can get no closer than the Volcano Observatory about 5 miles away.
We're getting pelted.
Got a little ash in my eyes.
At other times, avalanches or falling rocks make the crater a dangerous place to work. Walder says Mount St. Helens' massive 1980 eruption created the perfect setting to form a new glacier. The north-facing crater has steep walls that shade the bowl nearly year-round. It looks and acts like a catcher's mitt.
The snow avalanches off of the crater walls constantly during the winter.
The ice field got pushed around by the volcano's most recent lava extrusion, but the mass survived. Now the glacier has grown so fast, it's overrun instruments placed to track it.
It is advancing something like 100 meters, 300 feet in a year, roughly speaking.
So, is this an exception that proves the rule, or one that creates doubt? For his part, Walder simply classifies Crater Glacier as an anomaly.
It is certainly the exception, but it doesn't bear on the general phenomenon of glacier retreat throughout western North America.
At the southern end of the Cascade Range rises a different snow-capped puzzle. It's Mount Shasta. Measurements of Shasta's glaciers show 50 years of nearly continuous expansion. PSU professor Andrew Fountain explains the leading theory for why.
That area has been subject to enhanced precipitation. And when you're above the freezing level, that precipitation is snow, and those glaciers have responded.
The increased moisture comes thanks to a warming ocean. Fountain says the same mechanism is helping some glaciers on the northwest's tallest peaks, such as Mount Rainier, Mount Baker, and Mount Adams, to hold their own. But Fountain figures these glaciers can't buck the global trend much longer.
Well, we do expect it to be a temporary phenomenon. The modeling done down on Mount Shasta expects the glaciers to retreat within the next decade or so, if they're not already. And we fully expect the glaciers to begin to retreat more rapidly on these volcanoes in Washington and Oregon.
Fountain says the climate models call for the freezing level to rise. If that happens, less glacier surface will be nourished by snow and more will be eroded by rain. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
A search has been launched in the waters of southeast Alaska and Canada for a 67-year-old woman reported missing from a cruise ship. The passenger, who hasn't been identified, was noticed missing when she didn't leave the Sapphire Princess at the port of Vancouver, British Columbia this morning. The Princess cruise liner departed Ketchikan on Monday on an inside passage cruise. The woman was not located during a search of the ship, and her personal belongings were in her stateroom. The U.S. Coast Guard has sent a helicopter and boats to search for her. Canadian officials are also searching. The State Disaster Policy Cabinet has met to discuss a crisis at the Pelican Seafoods plant. Flooding damaged the plant's water supply in August and endangered the cooling system that contains anhydrous ammonia. Whether or not the town wins a formal disaster declaration remains up to the governor. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Jeremy Zedek with the Division of Homeland Security says the cabinet's recommendation will not be released to the public until it's been reviewed by the governor.
Discuss what the decision was, but we will process the paperwork and get that to the governor's office so they can make a formal decision.
The cabinet met last Friday afternoon to discuss Pelican's request for a disaster declaration. The Chichikov Island community filed its initial request in August after flooding damaged its water supply and impaired the flow of coolant to the compressors at the seafood plant. The refrigeration system there contains about 20,000 pounds of anhydrous ammonia, which might leak out if the compressors fail or if the system otherwise warms up. Temporary repairs have since been made to the 70-year-old water system, and the situation has stabilized. Zedek says that doesn't rule out a disaster declaration from the cabinet.
The state doesn't have to wait for a disaster declaration if people are in danger. Different state organizations, different departments, divisions can just take action if people's lives are at risk. Those dangers appear to have been mitigated, and so we're kind of looking at funding mechanisms now and looking to repair the problem long-term.
The long-term solution at Pelican will also involve keeping the freezers going indefinitely or safely removing or releasing the anhydrous ammonia, with the latter being the least expensive option, according to Cake Tribal Corporation CEO Steve Mullen. Cake Tribal has begun foreclosure proceedings on the seafood plant's new owners and seems likely to inherit the responsibility of dealing with the ammonia. Mullen estimates that the diesel fuel alone needed to furnish electricity to the compressors will run to $17,000 a month. Mullen told KCAW that he, too, is waiting on the state's disaster declaration. He said, "Is it right that the community of Cake, which has 80% unemployment, subsidize a much wealthier town?" Barring another solution, Mullen says he plans to work with a refrigeration expert recommended by the Department of Environmental Conservation to safely vent the ammonia so that the compressors can be shut down. But he adds that there is interest from another potential buyer of the plant who may want the refrigeration system just as it is. Jeremy Zedek says finding a path through all these possibilities is why the Disaster Policy Cabinet has taken up the Pelican issue.
When it's unclear where the funding can come from, when it kind of overlaps different departments within the state. So it's good for everyone to come to the table, have a discussion, then they can make a solid recommendation to the governor.
Zedek does not know when the governor's office will choose to act on Pelican's disaster request. He says every emergency is different. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
A government study of northern states says many urban streams have become salty enough to harm aquatic life, except in Alaska. The study puts some of the blame on salt used for de-icing winter roads. The U.S. Geological Survey studied urban streams and groundwater in 20 states, including Alaska, for levels of chloride, a component of salt. In more than 40% of the streams tested, the agency found chloride levels above federal recommendations designed to protect aquatic life. Most of those streams, however, are in the northeastern part of the country and around the Great Lakes. USGS hydrologist John Milani of the Connecticut Water Science Center wrote the report. He says the agency has been collecting groundwater and stream data for years in south-central Alaska, but the Alaska data shows no problems.
All of them, the maximum concentration measured, were all below our water quality standards.
The USGS report looks at streams near roadways in Nanilchik, the Kenai River below Skilak Lake, the South Fork of Campbell Creek in Anchorage, and Chester Creek at Arctic Boulevard in Anchorage. None of the streams were off highways in the interior or southeast Alaska. The report caught the attention of water quality specialists at the Department of Environmental Conservation. We just heard from DEC's Cindy Gilder, who confirmed the South Central streams were not impaired. The Alaska Department of Transportation uses more than 15,000 tons of salt on average each winter, with the bulk of it mixed with sand. According to the report, high chloride levels can slow plant growth, impair reproduction, and reduce the diversity of organisms in affected waters. The Moravian Church in Bethel was the first church to translate the Bible into the Yupik language. Since then, the Yupik Bible has been used by other denominations like Catholics and Russian Orthodox, where the congregation speaks Yupik as a first language. But the Yupik translation is from a long time ago, and some of the translations and spellings can be confusing to newer Yupik speakers. To update the text, there's been an ongoing project at Bethel's Moravian Church to translate the Old and New Testaments into a newer Yupik. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Alice Criswell reports.
Some of them are Peter Andrew's version, Elsie Mather's version, and Mary Jane's version.
Translating the Bible into New Yupik actually started in the late 70s or early 80s, but the church is focusing on completing the project in the next 2 years. This week, there are three translators working on the project, along with two translation consultants from the Lower 48. Elsie Jimmy is one of the Yupik translators. She is 68 years old and has taught at Kuigilngak for 25 years as a bilingual teacher. She is translating the old Yupik writing to the new Yupik orthography in the New Testament.
For me, I'd like for the younger generation to be able to read the New Testament in our own new Yupik writing system, the new Yupik orthography. They know how to read the new writing.
Jimmy says there are more people throughout the region who are helping in the project.
There's five of us here, but probably there's more, you know, that are involved in our area. Two translators, plus there's people who are involved in being resources. When we get the books done, the resource people are asked to read and correct errors or those kind of stuff.
Jones Annover is the pastor in the Quigilangak Moravian Church and has been helping the translators throughout the region. He says they work together, trying to make the best translation through editing each other's work. Bob Bascom is one of two translations consultants here in Bethel this week with the United Bible Society. The American branch of the group works on translating the Bible into indigenous languages in the country.
We have this one, Yupik. We have the Inupiaq up in Barrow. We have Lakota in South Dakota. We have the Choctaw in Mississippi. Those are our active projects right now. We also have American Sign Language. But I'm helping with Greek and Hebrew, trying to help them with that sort of thing.
The other consultant in Bethel, Brian Runes, is helping the translators with computer training.
Here in Bethel, I'm helping the Yupik team to make sure that the spelling of their words is correct and make sure that they're consistent in the way that the Bible is put together. So I help the translators to make sure when they print the Bible, it all looks good and is consistent.
Alice Fredson is correcting errors she finds in the translation of the Old Testament. She says the work is slow. She's been working on it since the mid-90s. She says elders today have trouble reading the Yupik Bible the way it is. She says they did a trial printing of their new version of the Old Testament and are now correcting that version. They want to make the new versions of the Bible the best that they can be. It will be something that lasts for decades to come. In Bethel, I'm Alice Criswell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ben Stanton in Kenai, Ed Schoenfeld and Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, Tom Bonsi in Portland, Alice Criswell in Bethel, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.